Good evening. You're listening to At Random. I'm Jackson. I'm a Sagittarius and I have a wonderful sense of humour.
And I'm Rick Timmish. I'm a Gemini.
And I'm John Wordsworth. And I'm a Pisces.
And this is At Random.
Cool. Well, so we've got some pretty cool topics to talk about tonight. It's a little bit of a geek fest, I think, isn't it?
It is a little bit, most definitely a geek fest tonight, but we also wanted to mention, of course, Andy, who sent us an email in and asked us to put some information in about PGP encryption. So for you, Andy, we're going to mention you right at the very start. Thanks for your feedback. We're going to get a mouse mat over to you in the post from those wonderful people at Abazanda. And we're going to do some boning up on PGP encryption and GNU-PG, and we'll do something on the next show for that for you. So, yeah, John, it is a bit geeky. Commodore.
Yeah. So, well, this is actually something which you showed me, but it's...
I'm excited about this, man.
The little hairs on my arm are starting to prick up again at the near motion of a new Commodore machine coming out. Or out, in fact, isn't it?
Out in the States. Yeah, it is. I just think it's so, so cool. And I was so excited when I saw this. You know, Commodore have re-released the Commodore 64, and it really does look like the Commodore 64 with all the big buttons on it and everything, except it's got an Intel chip inside and a DVD, and then they've got a couple of other models that go around with it, and I was just really excited about the whole thing. And what's really cool about it is that the operating system that they're supplying, it can run sort of three operating systems, so you can run Windows, and then one of the versions of Windows that you might want, so you can have kind of this historic museum piece, but actually, you know, ramp up and run Windows 7 on it if you want. And it also comes with Ubuntu Linux as an operating system, version 10.04, which is like, yay, from my camp, because that's, you know, open source support. But Commodore are also going to release their own Commodore OS version 1, and that's going to have emulators for the Commodore C16, the VIC-20, the Commodore 64, and the Commodore 128. And you'll be able to download Commodore games and load them and run them and play all the old little platformers and Jet Set Willy and all this kind of stuff.
I almost want to buy one just so I can get on my 1080p screen the classic blue monitor look with the little white flashing cursor.
Yeah, absolutely.
You want all the old menus, don't you, really?
So it's
the full experience, but it just runs properly and everything loads up instantly, like the best of all worlds, yeah.
And I can forget the commands to type in every time and end up typing in about 7 words before my game loads.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it's also going to be cool that, you know, your games load now off a disc rather than off a tape. You know, I used to have a tape device, and I used to have a screwdriver where I would go and adjust the azimuth adjustment. So on a tape, you can shift the head up and down against the thing. And I used to always twiddle with the azimuth adjustment to get it to load, because all of my games were pirated. And so most of them wouldn't load. Like, you know, it was always a bit of an occupation trying to get these things to load, whereas now it'll do it a bit more reliably, like as a downloadable app. So I think that's quite cool.
What I thought was really cool about the new rebirth of the Commodore was there's actually, well, they've all got submodels, but there's essentially three different types, aren't there?
Yep.
So there's the absolute classic Commodore 64 shell, which
I think it's the original. It does look like the original box. You know, maybe they got the molds out from somewhere, but I'm sure it is. Yeah.
I mean, it might sell as a cool situation party piece, but I'm not sure I'd want to spend 8 hours a day typing on that.
Definitely not. But, you know, the little red LED, the little red LED over on the right-hand side where it says Commodore that says I'm on, that's there. And then it just totally looks like the thing until you look at the side and there's a DVD drive, like this black rectangle DVD drive. But yeah, the keyboard is going to be that old, horrible kind of data terminal. Yeah, absolutely. Terrible experience. The one that I really like, the one that I'm really considering trying to order and get shipped over from the States, is the Commodore VIC Pro, which looks like a morph, really, between a modern-day PC laptop with like a little Synaptics touchpad and the Commodore 64 kind of blended into one. And it's a really beautiful-looking machine, and I really like the look of that.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the third one on the scale, so the first one is the classic chunky Commodore. The third one is that really sleek, slimline, sort of doesn't look much like a Commodore anymore. And the one you just mentioned, the Pro one, sits right in the middle, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's got enough of the old Commodore feel to be a Commodore, but it's a bit more modern. Probably not like business modern, but definitely home PC modern.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. And I just think there's something wonderful about it. So watch that space in terms of, you know, I'll come back and I'll be talking about that if I get one, if I get one shipped over. Definitely.
Thing is, where has this all come from? Because this is a very out of nowhere move. I mean, is there really like a demand for these living museum machines?
That is a really good question, and it'd be really interesting to try to get inside the marketeer's mind. I mean, obviously, Commodore have managed to maintain some presence in the States, in the computing space. They didn't completely evaporate at the end of the kind of the Amiga era. And so they've been tinkling along doing different things with bits of technology. And I guess they've reached that point now where there is this, I think there is this nostalgic niche market for guys and girls about my age that remember the Commodore 64 and that era, who are, you know, maybe we've had our kids, we're getting a little bit more spare time on our hands now. And to have one of these machines again takes us back to, you know, 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And hence the reason why I'm so passionate about, yeah, I'm going to buy one.
Yeah.
Well, there's a whole raft of people out there that are going to do that. And I think it very much is marketing to that specific niche is the thinking, yeah.
I suppose you might get away, because since it's all like an all-in-one machine, you might be able to market it to people who want like a very handy new piece of kit, because obviously it's like it's all up to spec and everything. So, they might be able to have some success to sell it to a new crowd as well, I dare say.
I mean, the Pro's got a quad-core processor on it, hasn't it?
Yeah,
so it's not. It's a proper piece of kit.
Yeah, it's not a toy or nothing, but...
And you can get a terabyte of hard drive space in it, you know, so, that, you know, it is a proper piece of kit, as you say. And I think, Jack, you know, it's got some ecological build. The Vic Pro, particularly, that's using like an Intel Atom chip. It's right in the mid-range there, 250 gigs of hard drive, 1 or 2 gigabytes of RAM, fairly low-power chip. Everything's built into the keyboard, so the keyboard sits on the desk and that is the PC. And as a form factor, I think that's quite neat, particularly in a business setting, as you say. That's going to sit on the desk, just plugged into the monitor with one wire. Next to it's going to be your wireless mouse. Well, you know, I think that's quite a polished offering in the kind of Apple sense of a polished offering. So, yeah, you know, I think that form factor may well work. And of course, you know, you can run obviously your Windows apps on it, and I think that, you know, the price point is good for businesses, so they might look to exploit that market too.
And actually, if you go right back to the Commodore roots, nowadays most televisions have got DVI and or HDMI input, and that would be pretty cool to just crank it out in your lounge, excuse the phrase, but you know, just pull out the keyboard in your lounge, plug it into the TV, and off you go. You know,
I hadn't thought about that, but that's another market
space, isn't it? Actually, use
it in the lounge
again, can't you? And play your games on your television, old emulated games or whatever. But you can just plug it straight into the TV and play it in the lounge, and like you used to.
Internet TV thing, the whole YouTube on your TV thing. So actually, I hadn't thought about that, but absolutely, yeah. With the latest breed of flat screen TVs, that same model works again, doesn't it?
And that was how I used to use my Spectrum. You know, everyone would go to bed and I'd sneak out of bed, get the Spectrum out and plug it into the TV. Now no one's watching it, and spend an hour or two just pushing those god-awful rubber keys. Yeah. You know,
I remember those two-hour windows before everybody got sick of the flashing lights and kicked you off. And then said, what have you done to my TV? It doesn't work now.
But anyway, really exciting stuff from where I'm concerned. You know, there's loads of information up on their website, and we've put information there on the show notes. There's a whole line with the Amiga, which we're not talking about here today as well. So, you know, those diehards that were into the Amiga, there's a whole set for that as well. And they look like they're going to be really powerful machines. So that looks pretty cool.
So just point your browser at www.commodoreusa.net, or, of course, at random.org. If you want to follow the link through from our site.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Jack, you're leading this evening. What's next up?
What is next up? I think we're going to talk a little bit about Sony's latest adventures in the in tablet space and in other fields. But yeah, they've got a couple of... They're talking about moving into the tablet arena, aren't they, Sony? Despite their,
this whole tablet thing seems to be moving almost as fast as our shows. I mean, we're doing one show every month, and in the first show we talked about the iPad, and the second show we then talked a little bit about the upcoming Motorola, Zoom and the Samsung.
Yep.
And then the third show, last time, we did more research into that. I've come back this time, and now Sony have got something out, and here we are again with another raft of tablets that are out there. But these look to me like they're more geared at the kind of gaming market.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, so they're bringing out a pair of tablets, innovatively called the S1 and the S2.
Yeah.
But
they want to make it simplistic, so it sounds like it's the last word in everything, doesn't it? Like, it's not no mucking about, no silly names. This is the PS1. This is the PS2. This is the PS3.
Simple, and, straightforward, and easy to hack.
Yeah, I like it.
Have you got an S1? I've got an S2. It works, doesn't it? Like the PSP thing, the PS1.
It's easy to tell where you are in the pecking order.
Right, it's not like they've called it Natty Narwhal or Obstinate Osterich or something like that, is it?
Those are names that want to be your friend. This thing doesn't want to be your friend. This is your ally
No dig at Ubuntu.
The pair of tablets are essentially pretty similar, apart from one of them is kind of the iPad. Well, it's 9.7 inch, but essentially the kind of iPad Zoom size screen, running Android Honeycomb. And the other one has an interesting clamshell design, where you pull it open and inside there are two 5.5 inch screens. Now they're actually interpreted, I believe, under the hood as only one screen. But obviously you can draw to half at a time. So you can use it as two.
So it looks like a great big DS, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got that look at it, hasn't it? Mm. Yeah.
And one of the big features that both of them will offer is to be able to play... Well, Sony have kind of said play old PlayStation games. And that, I've kind of extrapolated from that. And I assume they mean PlayStation 1. And or Sony PSP games from their handheld that's been out for a few years.
It'll probably be a good few more than that. I mean, they say they're going to be PSN enabled on the PlayStation Network. So I assume that means there's a lot of games on the PlayStation Network that run on the PS3, but will probably run on this as well because a lot of them are fairly simple. Well, for casual gamers, really, there's a lot of 2D stuff on there that isn't very that doesn't need a lot of power to run, basically. So I assume it'll play a lot more besides those. It'll probably play a lot of what you'll find on the PlayStation Network, to be honest.
That's assuming the PlayStation Network's up.
assuming Sony still exists.
Because what happened there, I mean, I'm not up to speed with this story, but it was a big hack problem or something, wasn't there?
Yeah, they got curb stomped by hackers.
Curb stomped.
Pwned.
We're performing maintenance to we may have a problem to we definitely have a problem to they took all the credit card numbers and all the information.
Oh my god.
And it wasn't even encrypted, the passwords.
They've updated us on that one, and that's not as bad as it initially sounded. So basically what they said is 75 million user details have possibly gone. Because obviously they've hacked in and they've tampered with the file. They've been around the files. Now, they don't know that they've been taken, but they wouldn't know if the hacker deleted his trail. Mm. So they're assuming they have. And the passwords weren't encrypted, but they were hashed. Mm. So, actually...
We're going to be talking about encryption and hashing next week, so...
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, hashing is essentially on a par with encrypting it. I mean, probably better, in fact, because if you encrypt it and you break the algorithm, then you can get everyone's passwords.
You need the salt, don't you? You need the
yeah, hashing's only one way as well. So it takes your password and turns it into garbage. And that garbage can never really be turned back into your password. What you can do is randomly throw passwords at it until you get the same garbage out, if you know the process. But actually, it's probably more secure than if they'd encrypted the whole
thing. There are rainbow tables as well, aren't there, that you can use against those kinds of things. So there are ways to decrypt it. I mean, what can you say about that? I mean, it's going to happen from time to time. Yeah. It's going to happen, you know, with the best will in the world.
And the big thing was obviously they're worried that the credit card numbers may also have gone.
Yeah,
and 10 million users have their credit card details stored on their account, so up to 10 million credit card numbers have gone.
I mean, just we've moved the world of hacking has moved so much because Now it is actually a commercially viable thing that, you know, the black fraternity, the kind of criminal rings, want to get access to that. But I think I've got one that may upstage that, because PSN got hacked, but obviously RSA, the people that make the encryption dongles that change every 30 seconds against the atomic clock, they also got hacked and had all of their hashing tables stolen and taken away. So that's 400 million high security CIA government officials, people in the European Parliament that have these keys. I mean, I was talking to somebody today who actually said the European Parliament now shuts down its systems at 5 p.m. at night because they can't let people in with these RSA keys because they can't trust that they're not being hacked.
Absolutely,
because, of course, all the data's gone. So so the hackers have been having a field day
recently. This is recently as well, isn't it?
It is. It's in the last 10 days, 10, 14 days, you know, so... It's plenty going on there.
Yeah, I wondered why I've been getting so many Windows updates recently.
There's no surprise, is it really? No surprise at all.
Just one more quick comment before we move on to our app reviews. But there was one final kick in the teeth for Sony, where 10 days after the initial hack of PSN, their other online gaming service got hacked, which was basically the online service for all of their online Morpork games, like roleplay games, DC Universe, and 24,000 credit card numbers got stolen from there as well.
Of course, this was just after they said that one was fine. They said, oh yeah, there's no problem here. Now this one's all right. Roll.
So I don't know which of the gods Sony have annoyed, but they're striking back with full retribution.
Well, there we go.
So right, it's a good time for us to move on to our mobile app reviews. And do you want to kick off, Jackson?
I'd love to. Yeah, I've got basically what I've got here is a beautiful little adventure/puzzle game called the Inferno, which is based on the epic classical poem by Dante of the same name. And if you're anything like me, you love a little bit of classical poetry with your games, so can't get enough of it. And obviously we've got the loading screen. The theme here is really tight, beautiful artwork.
You know, very gothic.
It's very gothic, yeah. They've really gone for the feel of the poem. We've got like all this artwork here showing the circles of hell, which is, I mean, it doesn't really follow the same story. It's loosely based on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's enough smattering of a story to give what's essentially a puzzle game like a bit of weight and keep you interested, because you're following the basic plot. You're looking to get your lady back. And here we go, yeah. It's got like character art and everything. You've got the basic story just here. If I try and tap past that, there's Dante. Yeah, Beatrice, that was her name, I've forgotten it.
I only know that because of that Xbox game.
Xbox
teaches you things.
This is giving you some background here. These people are effectively the characters and what they're saying. Is it that kind of background that I'm seeing there with that wording?
Exactly, yeah. And like I say, the story is fairly... It's fairly inconsequential to what you're actually doing, which is going through like this landscape, trying to. And there we go, I've fallen down a hole and died. You're basically going through these maze environments, and you're avoiding obstacles, ghosts, monsters, and it's like it's mainly reflexes and a little bit of luck.
It's kind of a platformer, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically a top down view we're looking at.
It's very reminiscent of the old kind of Amiga games.
Heimdall had a big selection of different sorts of bonus games, didn't it? This one's more the same kind of thing. You have to move fast or be killed. And if I can just... Oh, yeah, you get your checkpoints to make it a little bit easier. But essentially, the game proceeds like that. You're proceeding against a set of different tasks, which usually involve you having to either to think on your feet, react quickly, or else work something out, and then you proceed to the next stage of the story, which is really what keeps you playing this story. When it's taken seriously, they've clearly like thought a lot about the theme of it and the feel, and you do get a sense of playing through the Inferno. No, so yeah, I highly recommend that one. It's only £1.79, and as I say, the artwork is absolutely gorgeous, really immersive stuff.
It is, and again, I mean, it's got a real kind of Amiga look to it about it. I mean, when you reviewed Speedball last month as well, and that had that kind of feel to it as well.
Yes.
And there, you know, it's got quite a bit of a nostalgic element to it. I quite like the look of that, most definitely. Although I have to say, I was kind of getting a little bit lost there as to what the theme was. You seemed to be following these paths, and it just seemed to be the pace with which you went around that path that mattered.
Yes, yes.
So there's, you know, certainly from my point of view, that I'd probably need to play around with that a little bit more to dig into it to get a, you know, a bit better idea of the kind of game overall overview. But that's probably because I don't know anything about Dante's Inferno either. So when you were talking about that, I was a bit lost.
Sure. I mean, essentially, that's just the loose theme for it. I mean, it's not really essential to play in the game, but it just gives it like a nice backdrop.
Mm.
It's just a good thing, even if you don't know anything about the poem or anything, you pick it out fairly quickly because it's fairly classic themes going on. But yeah, lots of fun, really immersive.
Yeah, cool.
And that's 179.
179. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Awesome. What have you got for us today, Rick?
Well, in my traditional style, in fact, what I'm going to do from this little app is I'm going to send this out live in real time now, and I'll do it in a moment. But I've got Dragon Dictate for the iPhone, which is a little app that allows you to basically dictate a short note, and it uses Nuance's servers to turn it into text. And for sending things like a little tweet update or wanting to send a short email to somebody that's, you know, maybe only a paragraph long or something like that, this is a really good tool. And I didn't have to do any voice training on it at all. It just works straight away out of the box, and it's very straightforward to use. Just basically just put Dictation Dragon into the App Store, and you get a little green button, fire that up. And it just puts this little red button here in the centre that says tap to dictate. So if I just put here and say Dragon Dictate app review with John and Jack on the At Random show live now. Press the done button and it'll just change that. So it says Dragon Dictate app review with John and Jack on the At Random show live now. So it's translated that immediately in just a couple of seconds. Mm-hmm.
So now I can, there
yeah, it's got that bang on, which is really good. And then I can send this as an SMS or post it up to Facebook, Twitter or email. So I'll, as I said, I'll send that live to Twitter. So I'll just send that out. And that's now gone out to my Riptimist Twitter account and is live in my timeline straight away. And I'm able to put in something else and dictate something else again.
And that's pretty cool because you've presumably set your account up and now it remembers your details, so you can just post tweets or post to Facebook just by speaking and tapping a button.
Yeah, very, very simple and straightforward. There isn't much more to say about it than that, to be honest with you. You know, I mean, you just speak into it and then do whatever you want with it translates the speech to text and do whatever you like with it afterwards. I don't know how successful you could, you know, do an A4 page of text on it, because after it's taken probably a minute of audio, it stops and sends that off to the Nuance servers, because I don't think there is speech to text processing algorithms in here. It sends it over the network and then pulls back from there, because obviously, you know, it takes quite a lot of compute power to do that. But it is free of charge, so you know it's a completely free app. Download it from the App Store, use it, and it's pretty good. And it does give you an introduction into the desktop app, because Dragon Dictate from Nuance is available on the Mac and the Windows platform. And you know, as a desktop app, if it's only just a little bit better than that and can do an hour's recording or something, I think it would be quite a cool tool. Yeah,
sure. I've heard Dragon Dictate from years ago. It's been around for years, hasn't it?
It has been around for a long time, yeah. I think, you know, they came about on the market at a similar sort of time that IBM had released via voice,
which you
don't hear very much of now. So, yeah, that's Dragon Dictate from Nuance. Yeah.
Download it and see how many swear words it recognises.
Probably zero.
What have you got for us, John?
So I've... this is actually a bit of a classic if you're... an old, long-term iPad user, but I've only actually started using it recently. And this is kind of a social media web aggregator, I guess, called Flipboard.
Mm-hmm.
And this lets you add a whole number of either accounts or blogs or just general news feeds to the app. And you will subscribe to them and it displays them kind of in a newspapery type format.
It looks very much like a magazine or something like that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. So it could even be like a cover of Edge magazine or something. You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah.
But all the images which you see in the background of these kind of tiles here are ones that are obviously pulled down either from the articles or probably quite often see embarrassing pictures of friends on the Facebook one. But if I just tap on the Twitter tab here, then it goes into the kind of magazine page format here. But it shows you your content broken down into columns. Obviously, what's quite cool is you can just kind of keep turning the page.
It looks just like a magazine, doesn't it?
That's really nice, yeah.
It's beautiful. Where, absolutely beautiful, that is.
Where Walter Desmond here is linked to a Xbox Live game review, it's pulled that into the page. So I can actually read the first couple of paragraphs, see the image, and if that had a YouTube video in, then I could also watch that straight within the app. And then here's the page underneath. So it's preloaded the page for me if I want to actually read the rest. And then I can close that all down. But you don't lose your regular Twitter functionality either. So after reading that article within the app in this kind of newspaper form, if I decide that's actually pretty cool, I'm going to retweet it, just tap on the retweet button, and there we go, off it goes.
I love how uncluttered it all is.
This is the sort of app I could picture myself sitting back in the morning, possibly in the garden, with a cup of tea, just catching up with everything, but in a really like unpressured way, if that makes sense. Normally Twitter's the sort of thing where you alt-tab, have a read, alt-tab back and get on with your work again. And it kind of throws interruptions in your face. And
you could be sat there like Rupert Everett in his coffee shop, like just casually browsing the world's events.
It reminds me a little bit of, we talked about a few shows back. I brought the Times app and the Sunday Times app. And we talked then about, you know, is this reconstituting immaterial that's on the web in a different format and a layout, does it have any value? I think this demonstrates that absolutely it does. I mean, if you take things like Facebook and Twitter timeline, I mean, I saw there a moment ago, oddly enough, the tweet that I just sent out on Dragon Dictate was there on Flipboard in that timeline as well. But you know, it just, the layout looks beautiful, and it's just creating this like magazine, almost dynamic magazine that's just kind of changing in real time. And if you remember back then, I said about the Times, you know, the way forward for this kind of stuff is where you've got a newspaper that is updating itself and changing in real time. And this has got that, really got that about it. It's beautiful. They've done such a great job with the way that they are pulling it into these columns and the just layout style. All of a sudden, Twitter's coming alive like a kind of real-time magazine.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
And it's taken some real thought because, you know, pulling in these pictures, that's what makes it alive.
It is.
And they're all pulled in just from links that people have posted. So it goes to the site and pulls out, I don't know, say an image that isn't part of the template of the site. And 99% of the time, it's actually relevant to the article.
So it was originally just a bunch of like posts and tweets and stuff, suddenly becomes something a lot more coherent and accessible.
And that's a video it's hooked in here, is it?
Yeah. So if we tap on there, then that's a YouTube video which someone's linked to in Twitter, but just playing here in the app. So it's almost reminiscent of kind of Minority Report type newspaper, isn't it?
Yeah.
With the video on the paper, because it does feel very paper-like, you know. So there's a YouTube video that's
fantastic. And how much is that, John?
That's free.
Really free.
That's free for the iPad. Just download it from the iTunes store.
Need an iPad first, and that's not free.
So that's Flipboard.
Flipboard, yeah. Flipboard for the iPad.
I've got to get a copy of that. I'll have a copy of that before I go.
And you can see all of the apps that we've reviewed this evening on atrandom.org. Check there, and we've linked to all of them for you, so you can go and check them out on the App Store.
Hiya lads, it's Jerry just checking back out. Yeah, I'm not phoning in this week. I've gone clubbing with Sean Ryder. Well, I suppose we'd better take a moment to have a message from our sponsor. So we want the listeners of the show to get in touch with us and to interact with us. And that's exactly what Andy did, who sent us an email. So we'll be sending him one of our ISAM 007 mouse mats, which we've been kindly sponsored with from Abazander. So do get in touch with us. Abazander have provided these ISAM mouse mats for us that look quite cool, actually. I know you guys have got one each, and they're quite James Bondy, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're quite crucial looking, cool bit of of desk candy, desk eye candy.
Swish and glossy, that's what
yeah,
I'd say.
Yeah, I think so. So do get in touch with us. Email us show@random.org and make sure at the bottom of your email you put your mailing address, and when we read your email, we will send you one of these mouse mats, and of course we'll hopefully give you a mention on the show. So do get in touch with us, folks. John, what's next up?
So next up, we're going to talk... this is where we start to get really geeky now, and this is where I start to rub my hands together with glee.
This is where I rub my temples.
I think the first step of geekiness, Jack, you'll actually be quite familiar with, because we've spent quite a few hours chatting about this in the office. And,
oh, all right. That's all right. But I'll keep up with this bit.
I was going to just talk about the kind of a biomechanical physics engine that a game developer called, well, I guess a software developer called Natural Motion have developed.
Mm-hmm.
And they've developed it as a backbone engine that other people can use in their game. So it's used in a game called Backbreaker. And I'm not sure how much you know about game animation, but traditionally, if you're animating a character in a game, you'll motion cap someone, like you would for a 3D film, I guess. So there'd be a guy in a suit, and I'm sure you've all seen pictures of
the
guy
funny
in
little
a suit.
Ping pong balls yeah, stuck on them everywhere. Yeah,
little ping pong balls. And they'll run through the actions as if they were there in the scene fighting the massive troll on the peak of Firetop Mountain or something. And then those movements will be recorded into a file. The animator will load that file up into their software. Then they'll tweak the animations, because obviously some things which look right in real life might not look right in a cinematic cutscene when you've got all the lightning and things going on. But then that sequence will be recorded and then played back when you're playing your game. So at a certain point, I don't know, you put the knife in the troll's face, and that's the point it decides to play this pre-rendered sequence of 30 seconds of animation where all the characters go through these keyframes that were recorded right back in the motion capture suite months before.
Hmm.
What Natural Motion have done is where you might have a physics engine to, well, say in Angry Birds, there's a physics engine which determines when you hit this box in the middle, all the rest have to fall down in this specific way.
Mm-hmm.
They've taken the human body and have written a physics engine which can be applied to the muscles and bones of the human body to then produce realistic movement and animation of a human being under different circumstances without having to have any pre-recorded information at all. So, for instance, all you would tell the human AI is you want to get place B, you are at place A, it will then figure out how the legs should move. Now, presumably they've written some algorithms in to kind of limit the motion of the limbs to only work within certain realistic bounds.
Mm.
And then also they've kind of picked preferred types of actions. So if you're trying to get from A to B, it could crawl, but they must have programmed in it's faster to walk.
Yeah.
So then it will rear off onto its hind legs, and then walk from A to B, but none of those movements will be predetermined. So
it will just work. It'll
be calculated mathematically using physics.
Yeah, precisely. Mm. So for instance, if he's really weak, he would probably walk quite slow, but he might take a flatter route. But if he's really strong, but if he runs into a rock or something, it will move out of the way to compensate, and then but his hands will come up, because he'll see there's a rock in the way, and he'll push it out of the way. And there's some really cool videos online, and again, they're linked to from our website, where they've kind of got a guy, and they've poked him in random places with different strengths of forces to see how he reacts.
Mm.
So again, they've obviously programmed this kind of physics engine / AI to react realistically. So if you poke him in the face, he'll put his hands up in the way, first thing, to try and stop it. So if you poke him slowly, his hands will get in the way in time, and he'll push back against whatever force or object is going towards him. Now, if it's too quick, his hands will move up too slowly, it'll hit him in the face, and then he'll stumble back. But the AI is telling him to try and keep his balance, which then is fed through the physics engine to move his limbs in a way that he will try and do that.
Hmm.
Thing is, at that point, games that start using that kind of thing, it's going to get a bit spooky, isn't it? Because like it's not like actors like rehearsing their lines or like performing a part. It's like they're actually reacting to you now. So when you punch them in the face, it's like they're responding to it. And yeah, I think you really games really start getting good then, because you actually start caring about what you're doing, because it actually does have an effect that you can't predict. Or at least that the people making the games can't necessarily predict, because everything's reacting to you on the fly.
My brain just goes into an immediate meltdown because it just can't compute how on earth you construct software to do that, the kind of things that they are doing. I mean, it's just... I understand enough, and we did some on Deep Thought last time when we talked about the NVIDIA graphics chips, and we were talking about how we built up those images then. And I understand a little bit about 3D image construction and animation in tools like Blender, where you can effectively create an animated frame and then rig that frame and then drop a texture on it, and then you move the rig in, and effectively the physics engines there will compensate for all the lighting effects of the arms and so on and so forth, so that you can start to escape the bounds of having to animate each frame. To then have this, you know, this there's this the you obviously got this element of physics that's going on, and I can get that far in the sense of that, you know, if you push something in the chest with a force and it's got, you know, arms and legs, then, you know, the main torso where the main mass is will move first, then obviously the legs will trail. But then the moment the software then starts to make calculations like, I'm going to move my hands up, yeah. That for me is the AI side of things.
Yeah.
Well, you know, how do you program in those kinds of the decision-making processes? Like, I saw it where it smacked him in the eye, and it poked him in the eye, and he stepped back 2 paces and then held his eye like, ow, that hurt.
Exactly.
I mean, how do you write that? That's just like, you know, that. I mean, maybe that isn't written in. Maybe that's demonstrated for the show, but it gives the impression that that's written in. Well, you know, that's this model is now making a conscious decision about the fact that a person... You don't bring your arms up and touch your eye because of the physics of momentum.
No.
You touch your eye because of the interaction with your nervous system telling you that you've been injured. And so you bring this up for protection and so on and so forth. So that's not physics, that's intelligence that's doing that.
The AI has a desire to defend itself, and that's what I mean by spooky.
My mind blows
at
the moment that happens.
Exactly.
I mean, just to... Obviously, I don't work for Natural Motion, so I can't tell you exactly how it works, but I can tell you how I would... picture it working. First of all, the physics and how they've sort of broken the physics down. I believe they've still got a skeleton underneath. So some of the screenshots that we saw, they still showed the skeleton underneath.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, it's still kind of the simple, maybe 20, 25, even 30 bones, which define kind of the basics of human movement.
Yeah.
And then they've just kind of got skin on top of that, which moves around. But what I suspect they've added is essentially kind of a muscle system on top of that skeleton structure. So there is, obviously it wouldn't actually have any physical mass even in a game, because the visuals are different from the simulation. But there'll be two limbs, and there'll be a pair of muscles, one in kind of running down the fore of your arm, one down the back. And this set of muscles can only ever apply X force, and this set can only ever apply Y force.
Mm-hmm.
Which would then limit the motion that arm could take. So I'm guessing, I mean, that's how they've done the physics in it. So when you punch the guy in the chest, that's how it knows that the node nearest to where you punch it is going to move the most.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest are going to move less because they're further away from the bit that was hit. And also the muscles are going to try and contract to minimise the force of the punch. So you punch someone in the chest, and the little bit of bone in the middle of their chest moves at maximum speed. Now, you can't stop that because that's already moving. But then the one next to it is going to move at the same speed unless his muscles contract in a way that will slow it down in relation to the first bit. And that's what they'll presumably do with the AI.
Yeah, okay.
So then it will pull the force between the limbs, either to try and minimise the movement of the... flailing around with the hands.
Mm.
So if you ever play like a Crysis 2 or something and you shoot someone, when they die, they go ragdoll and their body kind of just goes fluff, 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 fluff,
yeah,
in an unrealistic manner. So in here, they'd have muscles that would stop that from just flipping around. But then, presumably, you program the AI to say, well, you're actually... Your preference when moving at a large speed is to stay upright. Now, to stay upright, you need to have your feet either side of your centre of gravity, sort of in the direction you're moving. If that makes sense, you know, like...
Yeah.
So you need to put your feet... If you're moving left, you need to put your feet further to the left of where you are and the other one slightly to the right of where you are to become stable again. So at that point, all it's really caring about are the feet and then the chest where you've punched them. So it will pull on all these muscles, and there'll presumably either be some clever... Well, there'll be clever AI. It could either have been built from a massive sort of statistical run-through. They might have run it with a million of these guys. And then with a neural network, it kind of picks the best option, now knowing, okay, after a million run-throughs, when I did this, I stayed upright. When I did this other 900,000 things, I didn't. So I'll do that one. Mm-hmm. Or they may have programmed it kind of logically, so it kind of thinks, well, hang on, this foot needs to be here for me to stand up, and this foot needs to be there. Pull on all the muscles in a desired way to get my feet there. And then the rest of the body will just, I don't care about it.
Okay.
Other than just trying to keep it together. So then it will just try and... I don't know, that's kind of how, yeah, I picture it. So it's very...
So almost got like... So what I'm getting from that then is that we've got a well-defined model that's moving within certain parameters, and what we've done to add onto the skeleton is almost created a muscle system. And then from there, then the AI is then dropping over the top of that almost predetermined kind of reactions to the force. So, you know, the force has hit you like this way, and then it'll have a set of a dozen or two dozen predefined reactions that it can take, and then it'll execute them, and then you end up with a result that looks really, really real on the screen, which it does look like a human being really, you know, poked in the eyes. It's quite amazing. Quite amazing. The American football game that they had play in there, where it said, you know, all of those models were effectively interacting with each other. And just doing their own thing on the game, you know, on the field. I mean, obviously, I found that a bit hard to believe, to be honest with you. I thought, do you mean that I can be one player and throw the ball in there and these other models will interact and sort of make the game up as we go? But that was kind of what it was suggesting. Is that what you got from it, Jack?
That's, yeah, I mean, as far as I could see, that's what they were saying. Yeah, it was all generated by this incredible engine. And like, I know sometimes they take like a little bit of license with like demo stuff, but that's just the cynic in me. But to be honest, I mean, I suspect for the most part that's exactly what it's doing.
I suspect that there are a number of AI classifications, so only a small number of them will be I want to chase the ball most of the time, and the rest will be I want to move into a strategically good place, as determined by what my coach, quote unquote, has said, and there'll presumably be areas in the pitch that they want to default to.
Now, this technology is being used in a game setting, but it shows some incredible levels of development in terms of not just modelling, but also in terms of artificial intelligence as well. You know, when you've got these models that now know how to react. You know, what happens if you... And we've already seen these 3D models in Japan of robots walking up and down the stairs and so on and so forth. But if you could build the frames and the models, the robots correctly, then how hard is it to transfer that kind of physics and AI into that real model, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, a bipedal droid that actually can operate in the real world? You know, it can be hit by something and it can take the appropriate action to remain standing up and so on and so forth.
That's right.
It can't be that far away, can we?
Not at all. I mean, as far as like simulating things, it's the perfect way to do it, isn't it? Mm. What they're talking about. I mean, you're talking about simulating physics from the ground up.
So, I suspect the remaining challenge is just the building of that skeleton.
Engineering
system.
Challenges, yeah.
It's gone back to engineering now. I suspect this is a major step forward in the software side of things. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's an incredible engine.
You have to see the videos. You've got to go and watch the videos on the site to really appreciate just how powerful it is.
And you don't have to worry about all the techie and geeky stuff we've been talking about. I mean, the videos are just cool, aren't they?
Yeah,
yeah, they are, yeah, most yeah, definitely.
So they're definitely worth checking out, and you can get the links on our website.
Just makes me think I'm going to start feeling bad about killing people. If this gets realistic enough, I'm not going to be able to play the game because I'll be too racked with guilt.
But it also shows you, of course, the level of processing power that's available today. Mm. You know, I mean, obviously they're going to be releasing these kinds of things onto the Xbox or the PlayStation or whatever with their emotion engine and whatever processors, what's Intel processor in the Xbox, isn't it? Is it an Intel processor in the Xbox?
I don't think it is. It's a PowerPC processor.
Right, okay, so PowerPC processor. But essentially that modelling is all being done on one chip on a board that essentially would have been done, you know, 10 years ago, you'd have needed something like the Met Office's supercomputer to do that on. So it just shows you the amount of resource that you're getting now out of these processor chips. I'm cocking up the segue here, guys.
I thought that was pretty slow.
No, it was going well till I chose the wrong chip for the Xbox. Never mind. Anyway, well, why don't I cut to the chase? I'm trying to segue, okay, from natural motions section to starting to talk about processors. And because what I found interesting there is obviously the ARM processor has started to become a lot more popular with all of these smart devices and mobile phones and the tablets and so on and so forth. ARM's driving so many things there. And I just wanted to get a bit of a conversation going, really, about the ARM processor and how different it is to the Intel processor. And we could even talk a little bit about PowerPC in there if we wanted to, for example. But one of the things that I've seen a lot of on the blogs recently is people struggling to compare ARM technology against Intel, because they will say, you know, for example, that the ARM processors aren't really good enough to go in desktop PCs because, you know, they only really run at 600, 800 or a gigahertz processing if you've got a Tegra 2, and, you know, Intel's i3 and chips are up at 2.4 gigahertz and so on and so forth. And what I found interesting about that is it harks back to 25 years ago in the early 8-bit micro days when the Commodore was about, where you used to compare chip speeds then, because you can't compare a gigahertz ARM directly against its clock frequency against an Intel chip because of the differences in the architectures.
Yeah, what might take 6 of those clock ticks on one chip might only take 2 on the other.
Exactly.
And if that rule is across the board, then that 1 gigahertz chip is 3 times faster in comparison to the
Correct.
One that takes... Yeah.
I suppose you can only compare them on certain specific tasks and see which one does it quicker, but then I suppose different tasks can attack it in different ways, is that right?
Yeah, that is right, absolutely. I mean, there are going to be different ways to benchmark different things. So, you know, for example, an Intel chip, if you are giving it quite complex arithmetic to do or complex operations to do, it can use its complicated instruction set that's on the chip to load things into the cache, and then it can have, the L1 and L2 cache on the chip that allow it to run defined sets of instructions that are like, well, they're called microcode on the chip, but it allows it to run everything on the chip and increase performance significantly for a particular job. So if you've got something that's quite mathematically heavy, then the Intel chip can perform that quite quickly because it can do a lot of work on the chip, whereas the Tegra 2, for example, has to go through the process of loading into memory and then following its very simple instructions, so it has to load in and out of memory. So for certain applications, Intel might be better in one environment than they are in another. But you might look at, say, an Intel chip doing a complex mathematical calculation at, say, 2.4 gigs, and you would think, right, you know, it's going to do that 2.5 times quicker than a Tegra 2. But it didn't at all. Mm. It may well be that it's only 10% faster. That 10% might be getting there because it can do some of the co-processing or its microcode gives it a little bit of an advantage.
Right.
Whereas the ARM processor, only has a very simple instruction set. So it doesn't have all the complexity that's on board on the Intel chip. But that simplicity allows it to be low power and allows it to execute its instructions very, very, very fast.
So when people say it's less powerful, it's actually more efficient.
Correct. It's more efficient, significantly so. And that's why, obviously, you get really great battery life. And that's what's allowing mobile phones and the tablets to have 10 hours. And some of them have got 16 hours of battery life on there. That's the ARM processor that's giving them that, because the Intel chips use a lot more power because of their underlying architecture.
Right.
And the two architectures are very different, and they go back way back, way, way, way back. I mean, the Intel chip comes from an early chip, the 8080, and then the 8088, which was an 8-bit, and then a 16-bit chip about 28 years ago, something like that. And the ARM chip goes back to the days of Acorn, so Acorn Computing. And they both used two different models. As time went by, basically programmers wanted to make their instruction sets on the chip. The programmers got lazy. So, you know, instead of having to create an indexed list, for example, a linked list of instructions, which requires you writing in assembler a whole sequence of code, they said, wouldn't it be really cool if we could have a linked list instruction in the cache on the processor? So the chip manufacturers said, yeah, well, we think we could do that. So they programmed these things up using microcode and stuff like that, mm-hmm. that they would put on the chip. That meant that you could use these functions of the chip that saved you time in your programming. The result of that was a much more complicated chip that used many, many, many more cycles to do that, to process that linked list or whatever it was you were doing. And it used more power, it was more power hungry, but it meant that programming could be a little bit lazier. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other paradigm, the one that ARM chose, is the reduced instruction set. So there what you have is you only have very, very simple assembly instructions. You can only load a register with mm-hmm. a piece of data, unload it. You can only do subtract and addition operations. You've just got a very limited set. So to get a linked list going, you've got to write that code in assembler every time and create those functions. So the job of programming it is harder. But when you write code like that, of course, you can optimize the code even better than it can be optimized on the Intel chip. So now you don't need as many clock cycles because, for example, to load the accumulator on an Intel chip might take 16 clock cycles to execute that instruction and put the data into the accumulator. On the ARM chip, it might take 3 or 4 cycles.
Right.
So now, if you think about that, then it can load the accumulator on the ARM chip 4 times for 16 cycles. And those 16 cycles, the Intel chip has only loaded the accumulator once. So although the Intel chip is running at 2.5 gigahertz and the ARM chip is running at 1 gigahertz, the ARM chip gets there 1.5 times quicker. Because of the way the instruction set works. So that's how the architecture is coming about.
But it does need to be programmed properly. You need to know
absolutely
what you're doing.
Yeah, of course you do, you know. Or if you're compiling stuff on it, then the compilers need to be correctly optimized. And of course now nobody writes things in assembler anymore. Everything's done by compilers, and the optimizations for the compilers are really good. Compilers that will compile to ARM architecture will optimize the code really well, mm-hmm. as they will, you know, C compilers onto the Intel chipset will optimize the code really well.
Sure.
Depending and will make allowances for the differences in the architectures as well. So, but also what I find very interesting about that, which is, you know, that I've always felt that the computing industry really came from the UK, sort of 30, 40 years ago. We were the forefront of that. Particularly with things like ENIAC and the stuff that was done at Bletchley and all of that kind of post-war stuff. We were really at the forefront. And ARM, which is so ubiquitous today, the reason for its invention was that Acorn, years ago, when they introduced things like the BBC Micro, they were using a really cheap chip, the 6502, which is in the Commodore 64, which is what we opened this show with. and the 6502 was put on most of the many of the micros because it was so cheap. You could fit loads of these onto one piece of silicon. So it was really cheap and low cost to do. The difficulty was that Acorn got involved in the very, very earliest set-top boxes where they were trying to deliver TV over fiber channel network or, you know, different things. And there was some government funding here in the UK to drive that program forward. Acorn found that they couldn't get enough processing power out of the 6502. So they decided to design their own chip in Cambridge. Sure. So they designed the Acorn RISC machine and they drew up this pattern for that chip, the ARM, Acorn RISC machine,
right.
ARM processor. So it came about 25 years ago or so that it was designed. And now, after all that time, and all the dominance by Intel, all of a sudden now, back, Acorn, or, you know, the ARM company, because they rebranded from Acorn to call themselves ARM, company is now back in the game with this really, really potent processor. And I think what the future holds for this in terms of devices is amazing. And the whole IT industry is going to be shifted because of this Intel ARM battle that's going on.
It's really interesting because we watched that video, didn't we, where there is that Motorola phone?
The A-Trix.
And you basically plug it into your desktop hub or your laptop shell, and then it powers the device. So it's essentially the whole computer running also as your phone as you're on the move. But when you plug it into this hub, presumably it charges at the same time. Then it powers your monitor and your keyboard and mouse all work and all the...
And you've got a desktop PC experience there. And then, as we saw in that film, you basically had the phone plugging into this, almost looked like a USB adapter, really, with half a dozen USB cables plugged in. And you just sort of plunked the phone in it, and then you could use the keyboard and use the screen, and it was a desktop PC with all the power and functionality of a desktop PC. Pull the phone out, and there was a little, basically a dummy terminal laptop that was just a screen and a synaptic pad and a keyboard. No compute power on board at all. Plugged the phone into it, and the laptop box operated as additional battery, an extension screen, and now the phone becomes a netbook. So none of this syncing or moving files around are required, because actually the phone that's in your pocket, now it is your desktop PC, it is your netbook, it is, you know, your mobile music device or your telephone or whatever.
It's really interesting. I mean, I've thought this for a while and quite often been shot down from my thoughts, but I'm sticking fast. I think we're going to see an interesting divergence in technology. I think this is a great example of that. I think on the one hand, things are going to move towards the cloud. People are going to want to start, you know, running their Google apps in the cloud and just having dumb terminals. But I think also things like this Sony fiasco, which we were talking about earlier, it's going to push a lot of people into not wanting anything in the cloud. They're just going to want it on one device, and they're going to want to carry that one device everywhere with them. So in that scenario, if you've got your top secret documents on your phone, as long as you don't leave your phone on the train, it's safe, you know. And
But if you encrypt the hard drive on your phone, whether it's a RAM, you know, a physical little disk or whether or whatever, if that's encrypted, then you could afford to lose the phone. Although I think you'd be pretty upset about it.
But you know, if it's all on your phone, you're going to put extra care into it because it's also your home computer and your laptop. But I think people are going to, you know, like we're seeing, everyone was like, oh, everyone's going to start moving to apps on the web and things, but actually I think the iPad has shown us that people want more native apps. You know, they want, I could read joystick through the web browser on my iPhone, but actually I'd rather read it through the joystick app because you get a customized experience. It's a bit like Flipboard earlier, and it's actually kind of diverging. You know, one side it's going to the cloud and the other side it's going back to apps and back to well-produced apps, because the development time for apps and things have got so small now that people can just knock out new apps which do really specific things and give you that perfect experience, which through a web browser you've got to contend with all the different browsers and all the different versions, whereas if you give them an app, off you go, it runs.
I think the model lies, it's an odd model, because I think that there's a huge amount to be said for the cloud compute environment and this idea that the internet now becomes the computer, and you know, things like Amazon's S3 and EC2 systems and so on and so forth, and all this kind of virtualization that we've got. I think there's a lot to be said for cloud compute, for high intense tasks and for large data storage stuff. But I think what you're saying, John, equally has its place as well, which is the convenience of not having to go over the network. Now, we're going to see massive improvements in network speeds when things like LTE becomes available here in the UK. That's 150 megabits. Over 3G networks, so over a mobile network, it's, you know, faster than LAN speed. So in terms of how your devices will operate in that environment will be much, much better than we see today. And that will offer a challenge then for native apps against web apps. But there's an awful lot of stuff that you're doing on your own, individually, your email, your other bits and pieces. Where the web comes into it and where it really matters is where we want to collaborate with others. Whether that be through social media, whether it's through sharing files or sharing information or working together in some group way on perhaps a database or whatever, that's where the network becomes imperative. And I think that that there's going to be a mashup really of this. I think that the consumer will get very excited about the idea of the phone that is the desktop, that is the laptop, that is whatever you want it to do, because it just offers you such convenience. All your files in one place, stored there. But how do you then interact with your friends? Well, actually, you're going to use Facebook and Twitter and the social media tools for doing that, and those tools are going to improve massively. If you're in a business environment, then how do you keep up to date with the other salespeople in the field, with the people back at the office, with the engineers out in the field and the project managers and the architects? Well, actually, the web compute systems, database systems in the cloud that are allowing people to work via the web or via a native app, those things are going to be ubiquitous as well.
I guess ultimately they're both going to come back together again.
Yeah.
Once they diverge, they're going to come back together into one super solution.
Yeah,
but we're kind of deviated a little bit from the.
That's pretty future. That's yeah. Three. That's at least 3 or 4 months down the road.
But I just wanted to pop back to the arm because I'm talking about this arm device as a laptop, netbook, phone. But I'm not sure if you've seen these gadgets before. They've been around for a couple of years. These are computers that you literally plug into a plug socket in your wall.
Mm.
And they're the size of a transformer, essentially, but they run on an ARM chipset. And one of the best things about these little gadgets, obviously, some of them don't even have a monitor port, you just access them across the network, but some of them have a little DVI out. But, you know, this little gadget runs on a 1.2 gigahertz ARM processor. Has all your network SD card sockets, so, because one of the limitations on them is they only come with a gig of storage,
mm-hmm.
Because these things only cost about 80 quid or something.
This one here is called a dream plug, isn't it? I could see.
Mm.
So we put something in the show notes for this. But yeah, I mean, the one I've seen that's similar to this is something called the Tenido plug, which uses something called Tenido software, and then a little plug-in device like this with an Ethernet port on it and a USB port for adding extra storage. And then it has the Tenido software on it, and the Tenido software is a bit like a BitTorrent, so it effectively allows you to create synchronizations between your mobile device, your desktop. And interestingly, this is another kind of solution to what we're talking about here, which is that for those people that don't want to have a Sony PSN situation on their hands, have all of their data nicked, they can get these little plug devices, which they stick plug into a device at home, plug it onto the network, and then with software like the Tenido platform, for example, it will sync your files to your mobile phone, to your desktop, and you just put Tenido on the phone, the desktop, and wherever you're on. There's a Tenido app for Apple, for example. Yeah. And then wherever you are, whichever device you're using, you've got access to all your files. And all of those files are actually sitting on a plug, plugged in at your premises. So now the data is not floating around in the cloud for some hacker to get at. Actually, it's back at home.
Yeah.
And that's another, you know, a really great solution, and I think that works really, really well for people.
I think these guys, you can run Linux on them too, can't you? So you can
just
set up your own
Debian. Most of them do run Linux, because obviously the Linux OS compiles well onto the ARM platform.
But I mean, what I thought was particularly cool about them was that they use on average something like 3 watts of power.
Yeah.
So, you know, down to 2 watts when they're idle and up to 6 watts when they're at their most intensive. But you think, even for a home user now, electricity is getting more and more expensive. And if you want something which you leave on all day and night, it's probably cheaper than your router, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you were thinking that's going to give you this with, say, for example, a USB hard disk plugged into it, or maybe an SSD or something like that plugged into it, that's going to give you the same kind of facilities that a server that was sitting in your corner consuming 250 watts an hour for 3 or 4 watts. So, and that's going to translate to £400 a year that you're going to save just on the cost in terms of electricity.
That little guy could sit there on BitTorrent or anything, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
What kind of storage do these things have on board? Do they have much storage, or would you need an external hard drive?
Typically, they're kept really cheap, so they come with like a gigabyte on the SD card just to store the OS.
Right.
So you would need to... Most of them come with a little SD card socket, so you can get a 32 or 64 gig SD card if you want to keep it in a plug, or you can just buy an external hard drive and plug it in.
If you want to use this thing as like a as a server, you need a big card or an external drive of some kind.
Yeah,
you could plug a 1 or 2 terabyte SATA drive into that, USB device, and effectively have oodles of storage there.
Yeah.
And because this is running the Linux kernel, for example, then you can do clever things like LVM, logical volume management, and have multiple drives loaded into it and managed, and you can do RAID storage for redundancy and all that kind of stuff just off a little tiny device like this.
Yeah.
So, really quite flexible.
And I would hazard a guess that even though it's only, 1.2 gig with half a gig of RAM, pretty competent web server.
Most definitely. It's understanding that difference between the ARM platform and the Intel platform. We think 1.2 gigs, not very fast. On an ARM processor, that's like a 2.4 i3 processor, something like that. It's going to give you that level of performance. Provide, if you were shipping files backwards and forwards, operating as a web server, if you were trying to do heavy-duty graphics or, really heavy-duty mathematics or gameplay, then you're not going to get the same performance. But then servers don't do those kinds of tasks. They typically ship data from one place to another. Maybe they do some encryption on the fly if it's SSH or encryption tunneling. All of that is well within the capabilities of that little, puppy in there.
So that's actually the dream plug, but there's numerous of these projects.
On the market. Plug computer is the thing to stick into Google. Plug computer, and you'll find loads of them out there, different ones that you can choose from. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I don't think you can get much more geeky and deep thoughty than that.
No, I think I'm all about mentally expended on that one.
So that's another at random show that you've been listening to.
Yeah, fantastic. Once again, get in touch with us. If you've got things that you want us to talk about on the show or you want us to look at, then email us and let us know and we'll bring those things up and we'll bring the topics up and we'll talk about some of the things that you want us to chat about. Remember to get in touch. Do send us your address. We'll give you one of those fantastic mouse mats from Abazanda. So I'm going to say good night at this point. I've been Rick Timmis. Nice to chat with you all.
Good night, all. I've been John Wordsworth.
I've been Jackson Matthews, and it's not an empty promise. You will get a mouse mat.